This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be considered legal, medical, or mental health advice. The views and opinions expressed do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the podcast and are not intended to malign any religion, group, club, organization, business, individual, anyone, or anything. I'm Sarah Edmondson.
And I'm Anthony, air quotes, Nippy Ames.
And this is A Little Bit Culty, a podcast about what happens when things that seem like a great thing at first go bad.
Every week, we chat with survivors, experts, and whistleblowers for real cult stories told directly by the people who lived through them.
Because we want you to learn a few things we've had to learn the hard way.
Like, if you think you're too smart to get sucked into something culty, you're already prime recruitment material.
You might even already be in a cult.
Oops. You better keep listening to find out.
Welcome to season 6 of A Little Bit Culty. This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp, but maybe it should also be sponsored by a company that manufactures blood pressure cuffs, because this episode is about Let Us Pray, a ministry of scandals, and that's Pray, P-R-E-Y.
Dare I say it chapped us? That series made us pretty pissed off.
If you haven't seen it yet, that's the infuriating, heart-pounding, and hard-to-fathom new docuseries about the darkness within the Independent Fundamental Baptist Movement, also known as the IFB for short, as we'll be calling it throughout this episode.
Let Us Pray premiered recently, November 24th, 2023, and you can also stream it on Max. And it's one of the top streaming series right now, and the fact that so many people have seen it already is a great thing, because it means a lot of people are getting wise to the IFB.
This is a shocking, appalling expose that has been a long time coming, way too long. You'll have to see it to believe it.
The series shines a light on a very dark and disturbing patterns of abuse within the IFB. We spend a lot of time in this content area, so we're no stranger to shocking stories. But we were still taken aback by what has been happening in the IFB. Side note, fuck you, IFB predators and enablers. Fuck you very, very much.
We first came to know about the widespread IFB allegations through our friend and fellow podcaster, Eric Skorzynski of the Preacher Boys podcast. He's done amazing work with that podcast as an advocate and force multiplier and in helping survivors sound every alarm and whistle possible on the abuse in the IFB.
And Eric's featured throughout the series. But the main focus is on the survivors, and it's a close-up at what courage looks like in real life. The women who have bravely come forward have mobilized a justice movement, even after going through things nobody should ever have to deal with.
It's staggering to watch, and it's inspiring. One of those whistleblowers is here with us today. Her name is Ruthie Heiler, and she's founded the Blind Eye Movement and helped put her abuser in jail twice.
And she's joining us along with Emmy Award-winning director of Let Us Pray, Sharon Leese. Word to the wise. The series and conversation broach the subject of sexual assault and abuse, so please listen with care. And another word to wise, go watch Let Us Pray and put your blood pressure cuff on, because it's really appalling what some of the people do in the name of religion.
Sorry, not sorry. Hashtag bless your hearts, hashtag not really, hashtag church too, hashtag hey IFB, time's up.
So much hashtag rage. Okay, little bit culty listeners, let's wait on. Here's our chat with Ruthie Heiler and Sharon Leese of Let Us Pray docuseries.
Hello, you two. Hello, Sharon and Ruthie. Welcome to A Little Bit Culty.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for coming.
We like to prep just before we interview our guests so it's fresh. So we literally just finished this morning episode 4. So it's fresh in our minds. And I would say that we were, how would you describe us, Nippy?
Say we were both crying at the end of it.
Yeah.
So it was pretty powerful what you guys have done.
So powerful. Let's start with you, Sharon, director extraordinaire. Can you give our listeners an overview of this series, why it's so explosive, and how you got involved? We're going to start there.
So I found out about the Independent Fundamental Baptist Churches from an article that I read. And it was an investigative piece by Sarah Smith in the Fort Worth Star-Telegram. And I'd never heard of the IFB before. And it was so cultish and so like Handmaid's Tale living today. And I read about these survivors who had left the cult and all this incredible abuse that was going on and these brave women coming out to tell their stories. So once I read that article, I talked to Sarah Smith and asked her if she could put me in touch with some of the survivors. And we first met Ruthie and, you know, just blown away by the courage and also just so shocked by the horrific abuses and the cover-ups that were going on. Because the cover-ups are even, in some ways, they're a different intensity than the actual abuse.
For me, the most infuriating too.
Yeah. And I do tend to do a lot of female-centric kind of storytelling. So this was just something that I felt compelled to do because I felt like I could help to amplify these voices.
So great. I wish I had filmed Nippy on the couch going like, how is this happening?
Yeah, I was punching pillows.
Pillows. And, you know, other than Eric Skwarzynski, who we, of course, we love and we've had on the podcast, like, where's all the other guys? I know there were some partners and boyfriends and husbands, but like, I just feel that there's just this network of men that are just so coordinated. It is beyond disgusting. And we were left that going, this is, I'm sure, the tip of the iceberg. How many other women haven't come forward? And also not just this denomination. There's, with the abuses of power that go on in with pastors and churches, this must be rampant.
Yeah, it was really shocking for me to find out that it's sexual abuse, emotional abuse, and physical abuse that goes on. Because the Independent Fundamental Baptist churches and movement is not just limited to churches. There are daycare centers, there are schools, there are unregulated boarding schools. So there's all kinds of ways that they infiltrate our culture. And people don't know, because I didn't know, that there are estimated 6,000 churches that are IFB, mm-hmm. and about 8 million people in America that consider themselves members. So it's really ubiquitous and it's really, really scary.
Was it so much worse as you started to dig in and do the series? Were you constantly shocked? Was it what you expected?
Yeah. And I'm like, it's so shocking to find out that when a teenage girl is sexually assaulted by a pastor and the head pastor finds out about it, that they don't do anything. Mm-hmm. That is so shocking. I mean, here, these are people who call themselves men of God and they turn a blind eye.
And it seemed at some point started to protect their own, which got me to think about the question of, there's this system out there. And I was wondering, do you think certain people see it and are attracted to it because they recognize they can get away with the behavior and then hide behind the religion? What comes first, I guess? Are these predators who recognize they can hide behind, you know, being sanctimonious, and they recognize they have an ecosystem like, oh my God, this is a place where I can get away with my perversion? How do you see it and how prevalent is it? And then are people unwittingly aligned with it? And when they become aware of it, don't do anything? Or like, what's the struggle that you saw in doing that?
I think it's a little bit of both. There's boys that are raised in this environment and taught certain things. And then they grow up to know that if they do these things, they're not going to be called out for it because they're a man. And so I think a lot of them hide behind that. And two, it's announcing, you know, to the public that they're not going to ever expose you. In our situation, a lot of what went on at Grace Baptist wasn't even shown in the series. But there was a situation where there was a bus driver that drove these buses to go pick up children to come to church who was a convicted sex offender.
Ugh.
He was a convicted sex offender driving the bus and then went on to abuse little boys that rode the bus. And John Jenkins told the paper that he was never a bus driver at the church. So he just lied and said, oh, not our fault. Instead of admitting, hey, we made an error. We didn't do a background check, whatever. It was, nope, we didn't have anything to do with this. And so they know they can get away with it. And they know that these, you know, some of these pastors are going to turn a blind eye.
Well, hopefully not anymore after this doc. But Ruthie, we were rooting for you the whole time. How have you been? First, let's start there. How are you doing now since the doc came out?
Good, but slightly overwhelmed. I mean, I think we all knew that this was a much larger issue than really any of us were aware of. But ever since it's been released and all the messages that we've received have just been a lot. There's so much. And it's just fueling that fire and letting me know that this is very important. Speaking out about this is so important because there's still children in these IFB churches that are hearing this, you know, these pastors to this day. I mean, a man just preached a sermon shaming me for going to Washington and saying it's my fault. So there's still children hearing that and knowing that if they come forward, they're not going to be believed. So slightly overwhelmed with how many people are coming forward, but at the same time, reminded how important this was and the goal that got us here.
Right. Well, we get it. Trust me, more than probably many other people. And amazed by you for founding the Blind Eye Movement. And, you know, really want to thank you for even doing the series, because we know that pursuing justice, especially, you know, in the public eye, is just super weird and hard, but it is a very important light that's needed. So we make sure that you know, bravo to that. And I'm sure you feel it with every message of every person who reaches out to you.
I just felt like it was the right thing to do. So many people say, you know, I'm proud of you. And I feel like it's not really that. It's the human thing, like the decent thing to do. And so I understand people feel proud, but I'm just like, this is just the right thing.
Can I also say that Ruthie is, I mean, the thing that really, one of the things that got me about Ruthie is that she is really committed, and the other women in the Blind Eye Movement, committed to this not happening again. And I don't know why that is at all like surprising, but you would think that after you've experienced all this abuse, the last thing you'd want to do is be hearing about another person's abuse. You know, you'd want to just like put it away and be done with it and move on with your life. But Ruthie and the other women are so dedicated to helping other women. And really, anytime I would interview Ruthie and we would start talking about other women or why she's doing this, that's when she would get really choked up. It was like, I don't want to see this happen again.
Yeah.
And she's just really so into doing that. And the other women who also helped found the Blind Eye Movement are the same way.
I think that's something that, well, I certainly can really relate to.
It's hard to walk away from knowing that someone's out there doing this.
Yeah. I think that a lot of survivors, well, there's two things. Like, there's like, this is a different era, you know, 70s, 80s, 90s. What do you call the knots? So much suppression of this information. And now there's this wave of sharing survivor stories, trying to, you know, make a template for others to leave and to heal.
And a belief that justice can prevail.
Yeah.
People are going to jail.
And you did that, Ruthie.
Yeah, I did that.
You did that. I hope you really like remember that on the hard days. You did that. And yeah. We'll be obviously encouraging our audience to watch the whole series if they haven't already. Most already have, because our audience is like on top of these things.
They've been telling us about it for a while.
So. Yeah. Ruthie, how did it feel to put your abuser behind bars twice?
Yeah. So it's not very often that a victim of sexual assault can say that. Mm-hmm. So I feel vindicated. Also, though, the second time, like I never knew that was an option. So when the detective said it was an option, when I said, yes, I want to press charges, it wasn't necessarily just for me, but for other victims that didn't feel strong enough for one reason or another to press charges. So when I gave that impact statement, it wasn't just for me. And there was a part that was cut out, but I told him, you know, this is not just for me. This is for, you know, who I'm talking about. Because my sister was also abused by him.
Right.
So I think, to me, I always view the first time as for me and the second time for her.
Oh.
Yeah. And I'm glad he's where he belongs.
Watching him plead guilty was, I think, Nippy and I were just talking about, like, you know, doing this podcast, it's a lot of trauma and like hearing a lot of trauma. We go on that ride with the survivors, but we also get to go on the ride of the wins, you know, emotional to see that trial and the sentencing. And I think that will be an inspiration for a lot of people to speak up, compared to the many years of shame. And there were so many years, so many decades where women couldn't speak up. And now there's this new era. And I imagine there's also a time when, like, feeling less alone, even though it was a traumatic thing, but to share it and find other people that have been through it, you feel less alone and can rebuild your life from a stronger place. What does that feel like when you found your team of the Blind Eye Movement?
It's a different level of not feeling alone, where you have the aspect of, yes, the sexual assault, but also the environment we were raised in, and they completely 100% understand all sides of that. And so to have that and not feel alone and understand, okay, this is why this kind of happened that way. It's just a different level of healing to not feel alone. And we've had so many people reach out to us that, you know, said, hey, the statute is up or my abuser has passed away, but hearing you give your statement, I felt like I was there with you. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of the whole point. We're a beacon to other women or men that have gone through this in the IFB. And, you know, you're not alone. We've been in the same situations or similar situations, and we know exactly how you're feeling. And yeah, just giving people hope that they're not alone in any of this.
What would you say to someone who might be going through something similar and might be listening to this? Like, what are their options?
There is an out. People outside of the IFB are not bad. That was one thing that was kind of drilled into our brains that, you know, CPS and all of this, if CPS is called, you know, they're going to take your kids and you'll be taken from your family and things like that. And that put that level of being scared to report abuse, even to parents. And so these children are really isolated in this environment where they feel like there's no out. And there is an out. Even if you message me personally on Facebook, and I will explain to you where you can go and report what's happening. But there are people that love you and care about you and will be there in a moment's notice to help you.
Have people done that? Have people reached out to you on Facebook?
Yeah, I have a lot of messages, mostly in show of support, but there are people that still attend a church and have asked me, you know, have you had any reports on this person? What should I do? You know, there are situations like that where people are hearing us and even within the church are reaching out and asking, you know, how can I help or what can I do? And it's just,
that's good.
It's a positive thing. Yeah.
The prosecutor in Michigan let me know that this week he met with five women.
Wow.
Who want to tell the stories and want to press charges.
That's amazing. So the documentary is really having a big impact.
Yes.
It's huge. And I would say it's huge in the level, on many levels. One level is the empowerment. And for me as a filmmaker and a storyteller to, you know, I'm just the vessel, you know, and I see these women feeling so invigorated and so empowered that their stories are being told. I mean, fortunately for us on the filmmaking team, that the women are happy with how the stories are told.
Good.
We're careful to do it in a way that would honor them, but because they're taking to social media and they're doing press and they're talking to other survivors. And I'm hoping that whatever shame is left gets to be washed away from what's happening now. There's protests that are going on. There's a big thing that's going to be happening at the mega church in Hammond, Indiana. And so there's a lot that happens when people use their voices.
So great. Has there been any new updates since the documentary came out? Like, has anything, any major things happened that's not in the doc?
Well, Amanda Householder's parents were supposed to, their trial was supposed to happen in November, and that's going to happen sometime in 2024 now. And they're facing over 100 felony charges.
Wow.
For running an unregulated boarding school, using children in various ways, various disgusting ways, and also abusing Amanda when she was a kid, forcing her to restrain and give punishments, as they called it, to other kids.
Your footage of the school was harrowing and like a horror movie. I was just so disgusted and also so shocked to know that these things are still happening and that there's so many unregulated, unlicensed boarding schools. I say that in air quotes because of the church.
Yeah. And I don't know what the percentage is, but some parents have no idea what they are sending their kids off to. And some may have an idea. But either way, it is just, it's unfathomable what happens to them and what goes on in these churches and then in these boarding schools. And then you see, like in Kathy Durbin's situation, it's like a Twilight Zone nightmare when she says that her mom came and she's ready to tell her mom what happened. And they say to her, well, they already talked to her mom, says to her, they already told me that you would say this.
They taught her to gaslight her.
Next level.
One of the things, like when we were approached with our story, you could tell how educated people were on this kind of abuse by the questions they asked. And I'm wondering, did you feel like you had to educate yourself before you went in on this? Or was it kind of, I'm going to be sensitive to the subject, learn as I go? What was the process for you going in? And
As a filmmaker
and getting these stories out? Because I imagine there's a certain sensitivity you already had. There were just people that wanted our salacious story. Then we had filmmakers that asked us nuanced questions that really sought to understand it. And I'm wondering what your process was and what was it like from when you started to what you learned by the end of it?
Well, yeah, like I said before, I'm very interested in female-centric stories. So I've done a lot of sensitive subject matter. I did a film about trans kids in the Midwest. And so in terms of, you know, learning how you establish trust and how you collaborate with your subjects, and these were kids and then their parents. So that was, you know, over time you do learn from different projects. Mm-hmm. I also had a personal interest because my daughter as a young girl was sexually abused. So I have a particular sensitivity to the topic, but it certainly was a learning process for me in terms of the interviews, because we realized that we needed to spend more time than you do in a typical interview.
Yeah.
I mean, double the time, because you need breaks. And also there's more to the story that just needs to come out that we don't even use, you know, that is on the cutting room floor, so to speak. But the whole story needs to come out. And it was really important for me and my co-EP Sam to really hear the stories and to know, you know, a lot of the things that happened, whatever the women wanted to share.
What was that like for you, Ruthie? Had you shared it in that context before at all, like in therapy, or was it new?
No. So talking to Sarah Smith, who did the article that kind of started all of this, was probably one of the first times I'd ever talked to somebody that I knew it would go public.
Mm-hmm.
The rest of the time, I mean, I talked to more closer circles and people that I knew through the grapevine somehow. So no, definitely not in this type of setting or with multiple strangers in the room. So it was definitely different than any other time.
And did you have therapy set up? I know the Vow did that for us. They gave us therapy and kind of took care of us in the aftermath. Or how did you deal with stuff as it came up? Did you have somebody on set, or what was your process?
We offered some counseling. Actually, because it would be confidential, I don't know if anybody took us up on it.
No problem.
But we did offer that. We did not have anybody on set, but we did. And I know some people have their own therapy that they would need to talk to. But there were times where we needed to stop interviews,
right,
and stop for the day because it was too much. And, you know, we had to understand that. And you have to, you know, and in the producing side of it, you just have to take a breath and go, okay, you know, this is trauma talking and we just need to regroup tomorrow.
So good that you did that. I've done so many interviews about NXIVM, and I definitely felt the difference between a team that got it and a team that didn't get that.
And also a team sensitive to recognizing you're going through it while they're interviewing, as opposed to with the intellectual hindsight of a lot of it going on too.
Yeah. I mean, and we also were committed to having an all-female crew as much as possible. So our cinematographer, Yamiche Shminovitz, is a woman, and co-EP Sam. And what we also felt was really important, which you may have recognized too when you were going through this, is, well, for us, we wanted to have female audio recorders, because the audio recorders is all over you, putting the mic on
so
you,
great.
You know, actually physically touching you where they ask permission before, and in the room, and they have the headphones on and they're listening. They're the ones that have to say, oh, excuse me, you know, a truck just went by. Can you say that line again? And then the person who's being interviewed, you know, if Ruth is being interviewed, she's like, oh yeah, there's Anna. She's in here too, listening to me. So everybody really needed to be sensitive, and we mostly had women in the room, and we would have as few people in the room as possible when we did the interviews.
Right.
Can I mention one more thing about the interviews? So our interview setups, our environments were really important to us, and we collaborated with the subjects to make sure that they were okay with what we wanted to do, and also felt like it would be a good thing, because we wanted it to be like a space that they could reclaim. Mm-hmm. So for example, Amanda Householder is in an isolation room, ooh, which is what they had in these group homes. So we would talk to her about it, and, you know, what would be important to you and what could be something that people will know, you know, relate to your story about, but that you could also reclaim the space and it could become a safe space now. And so we built that room that she was then did her interview in. And at the end, we don't have this in there, but she took off all the carpet on the walls and just like ripped it off and like threw the box that she was sitting on.
I would have loved to have seen that.
For more background on what brought us here, check out Sarah's page-turning memoir. It's called Scarred, the true story of how I escaped Nexium, the cult that bound my life. It's available on Amazon, Audible, and at most bookstores. If you want to see that story in streaming form, watch both seasons of The Vow on HBO. You've heard from our sponsors. Now let's get back to a little bit culty, shall we?
I think this is so great. There's so many cult docs made right now, and you can tell when these elements are in place, but I hadn't thought about the female sound person. And Nippy, you wouldn't know this as a man, but having a man, especially like I also do film and television, right? But on a Hallmark film, there's often a man strapping a mic to my inner thigh, you know, like it's very intimate. And we joke about it like, and it's just like, no, that's so not appropriate. You think with technology these days, there'd be better ways, but having a female sound person that's brilliant. I commend you for that. And we're super sensitive to the debt of responsibilities that documentarians owe to whistleblowers to take care of their stories, like in general, not just whistleblowers, but anyone who allows the story of their personal trauma to be the focal point of a piece of filmmaking and a source of content. Streaming content. And as we've mentioned, we've had a great experience working with the team that made The Vow, but we also know lots of survivors of other cults and other groups, you know, have a second kind of hell once they've escaped various environments because their lives got turned upside down by flimsy filmmaking or gotcha editing that turns their pain into popcorn viewing. How did you keep the survivors front and center, and how did you all work together to not do that?
Well, at a team, we also had 4 female editors, and we worked as a team. And then sometimes when, I don't want to get too much inside baseball, but you know, sometimes when it's multi-episodes that you'll just give one episode to one editor, you know, and then we try to smoosh it together. But in this, we felt like all 4 editors needed to work on the same story at the same time so that we were all really coordinated, and all of the women, we would just talk about how important it was for us to honor what they would say. And Sam, the co-EP, is like, she doesn't forget anything. And so when we would go through cuts, she would go, that's not exactly what happened. Or that person didn't want to mention that other person. We can't use that name. So we would like go in and extract things. And we just constantly kept doing that. And we just had to notes process that was really elaborate.
And Ruthie, how did you feel when it finally aired, and what was your take on the final cut?
I thought it was amazing. I think Sharon, Sam, and the rest of the team did a great job at telling our truths and putting it together to where people outside, even outside of the IFB, would understand. So I think they did a great job on that. And I drove my husband nuts, jumping up and down on the couch and acting like a child a little bit, because there were parts, like when the part about John Jenkins was put on the screen, I was like, yes, I'm so glad they included that his statement compared to what we looked for and can't find. And it was evident that he was not telling the truth. Mm-hmm. So there were parts in there that I was very excited about. My only thing is I wish it was longer. I wish more could have been put in it. And I think that's probably everyone's complaint, because there's so many stories that weren't able to be shared because of the time constraint and just going deeper into the connections and how things were covered up.
Which is a good segue to the question that I have. So you have the world pre-doc where these churches are getting away with this, and maybe an ecosystem within, say, the town that it's in where people know. What do you think needs to change, not necessarily within the church, but within the surrounding area where people hear about this and it can't thrive and continue? And do you think your doc has put a dent in that? You know, I know there's 6,000 of them, but do you think the tide is turning, so to speak, where this stuff can't exist?
It seems almost impossible, but not impossible, to change the tide, because they have such a stronghold on the community. And what I learned was the fear of God in the people to like believe something else than other than what they're being told. But I'm seeing some things happen that I think are incredible, like these protests and lawsuits and people speaking up and using their voice. I also think that the communities might start paying attention a little bit more, because you see in the doc where Ruthie and the Blind Eye Movement tried to warn the next church that John Jenkins was going to. And I don't understand. How do they not, when an abuser lets you know this?
It blows my mind when I see that. It's so infuriating to watch that. I can't tell you. I mean, I'm sure you know.
There actually has been several people from that area reach out to us. They actually have a petition going to remove him, which
great.
Awesome.
I don't know how much good that would do, but it's something to show the community is actually aware and warning the rest of the community that, hey, there's this pastor that, you know, turned a blind eye to abuse and he's over this other church. So I think at least where that comes into play, that community is warned and hopefully they'll think twice before they send their kids there. So
good.
And the statute of limitations also is something that needs to be addressed in these states.
Yeah, which Michigan, it passed through to go to the floor to be voted on. Representative Brixey got it through. So hopefully that'll be changing here soon.
Amazing.
This podcast wouldn't happen without our amazing, supportive, generous patrons. Are you with us? Come find us over on Patreon at patreon.com/alittlebitculty for bonus episodes, exclusive content, and the occasional Zoom with our fan favorites from our past episodes. It's a lot of fun over there, people.
You've heard from our sponsors. Now let's get back to A Little Bit Culty, shall we? And, you know, as ex-cult members and podcasters here in A Little Bit Culty, obviously we're always seeing things through a certain lens. And it was very clear from the beginning for us in terms of, you know, the isolation of the community, the us versus them mentality of the, you know, congregants using shame and the love bombing of the grooming and all these different steps that the predators used with all of their victims. When did you, Ruthie, as a survivor, put the cult connection together in your mind, and how did that happen?
So I would say after going to like my third IFB church, because they like to argue the fact independence in their name. So they're not all connected. And that's their argument. Well, that was just a bad church you went to. But after my third church, and they were all cookie cutter, and the pastors were all the same egotistical, you know, horrible people, I said, okay, there's something not right here. And that's kind of when my eyes opened and I was like, this is definitely a cult.
Did you read something, or like, what's your cult education been?
I don't know that I necessarily have any education other than just kind of seeing other cults on TV or whatever.
Right.
You know, like the Amish is like a big one, because the IFB has very similar, I don't want to say beliefs, but like the dress and stuff, it's just not as, it's more modern, but obviously we don't have to wear the bonnets and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But it just, when they start controlling everything you're doing outside of the church, even in your own home, it was just very evident that it was more about control than a religion.
Yes. Well, I really hope that current members of the IFB listen to this and watch the doc. Is there anything our audience can do to help infiltrate, for lack of a better word? How can we help?
I think the biggest thing is just educating and promoting the series, promoting the Blind Eye Movement page, making people aware that these churches exist in their communities, and just keeping an eye out for it. It's hard because I wish there was a better answer to how we could change all of this, but it's very hard when these churches kind of isolate the people the way they do.
Absolutely. Isolation is such a key element. I want to share a couple of resources for you to share with your Blind Eye Movement. One of them, there's a new addition out to this book, is Take Back Your Life by Yanya Lalich. Is that on your radar?
No.
No? Okay.
Must read.
It's a must read.
First one I read.
And maybe even first, given the religious content, but we just interviewed this author, Dr. Laura Anderson, When Religion Hurts You. And I think that this book, and it's also on Audible if you don't like to read, I personally have a hard time reading since leaving NXIVM, is a really, really wonderful resource, a very practical roadmap to healing after being in a high control religion.
Definitely check those out. I think the first book, it wasn't really about a cult per se or religion, but was The Body Keeps the Score.
Yes.
Yeah.
It was one of the first books I read pertaining to sexual abuse. Mm-hmm. So I like reading those types of things. They also feel, you know, make you feel not so alone, mm-hmm. like somebody gets it.
Yeah. Well, and Dr. Laura was in, I'm blanking now, I think she was in IBLP, which has an overlap with IFB, right? There's a lot of...
Yeah. They're very similar. Mm-hmm. I remember when the Duggars went on TV, I was like, are they IFB? Because it's very similar. Just the way they dressed and having as many kids as possible and all that was very similar. Yeah.
So Ruthie, what's your plan now? What are you going to do now?
Well, I'm going to keep sounding the alarm for as long as it takes until IFB, you know, children within these churches are protected like they should be. I mean, I don't have a problem with religion if you want to believe what you want to believe, but you don't have the right to abuse and control and manipulate. So it's not the religion I'm attacking like some people would claim, right, especially IFB.
Noted.
Making sure those children and the next generations are protected. And unfortunately, I have very little hope that that day is going to come. So I probably will be sounding the alarm the rest of my life, but I will gladly do that.
Well, you have a platform here.
Yes. This reaches a
lot. An amplifier.
Well, we'll just amplify your call to action. It's funny you said sounding the alarm, because that was Nippy's line as we were leaving Nexium, remember?
Yeah.
When people were giving us shit from inside Nexium, we're like, we're destroying the community. And he's like, oh, I'm just sounding the alarm.
Yep. Just pulling the fire alarm.
Which he also did in, was it sixth grade?
Yeah.
Sixth grade, it got grounded.
We got suspended.
Suspended. Separate note. This is a pattern. Yeah. Sharon or Ruthie, where can people watch the series and where can they find you both? Start with Sharon.
So you can find the series streaming on Max.
Okay.
Called Let Us Pray. And you can find me on Instagram under my name, Sharon Lease, or on, do they call it X now? Under Sharon Lease also, and Facebook Sharon Lease. So I'm kind of easy to find.
Amazing. And what's next for you? Or are you recovering from this project?
I have a project, a film that premiered at Sundance earlier this year, and is now available on The New Yorker called Parker, and it qualified for Oscar consideration.
Amazing.
So there's that. And then I've got a few things in development right now.
We love your work, and we really thank you here at A Little Bit Culty for creating something that was so survivor conscious and sensitive.
Well, thank you. I mean, I love all my projects in different ways, and I'm proud of them in different ways. This project in particular is meaningful to me because I can see the impact, and I can see the personal individual impact on each of the survivors, but then I can see the larger impact as I see things getting shaken up and moving, and maybe something will change.
I hope so. I hope so. And we are also just really especially proud of you, Ruthie. It takes a lot to do what you did. A lot of guts.
Hopefully we'll hear more about it.
We were just rooting for you from the beginning. We know what it's like. And I think you were up against something so much bigger than we were. And we really took note of that. And I hope that you're, I know you said at the beginning, it's not really pride when people say, I'm so proud of you. I get that too. It's like you did the right thing. You did the right thing. It's the right thing to do. But it also has a huge toll on your life. And just make sure to, it's my unsolicited advice, is just like, take care of yourself and make sure that you take time to heal and, you know, breathe and have hot baths. And well, that's what I do. You don't have to do that, but.
Yeah. I'm the same. Yeah. I love baths. But it's funny because the IFB has this term they use of breaking a child's will. Mm-hmm. And I'm proud and happy to say that didn't happen.
Yes.
And I'm not a quitter. So.
Good for you.
Not a quitter. You're not a sheep.
Nope.
And you are your own person.
Will's not broken.
No. That was something that I really took away from the series. And I just wish I could give you a big hug. And so I'm sending you a big virtual hug from across the country.
Can I just add that it was really important for us. There was a scene that could have gone a lot longer, of course, that we called Meat and Cheese, M-E-E-T, because we had the women when they were in Wildomar, and they were just relaxing and talking and drinking wine and you know, having cheese and crackers and meat. And we really wanted to show that these women are people and are survivors, but are not just survivors. They're not only defined by being a survivor, that they can bond and they can talk about other things and they can enjoy life and they experience joy and they have families and kids and they love and are loved. And that while it's difficult and there are really hard days and probably hard parts of every day, they're people and they take in the good in the world too. And I think that is, you know, that was really important in terms of our editorial that we wanted to get across.
I think you did.
It read that way for sure.
Yeah. And really profound moments, especially with presenting the women with the tape on their mouth and then ripping the tape off. Again, takes a lot of courage. So thank you for doing it. And please, please consider us resources if there's anything we can do to help in the survivor space.
Yeah, sounds good. We'll take all the help we can get.
Sharon and Ruthie, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for making this very important documentary and for making it so well. And I appreciate you being on A Little Bit Culty.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you for having us. Yes.
You're a badass, Ruthie.
We did say that after court when we all walked out.
Yeah.
I didn't get in there, Sharon.
Well, we'll stay here. We'll stay here, Sharon.
I think we all were standing in a circle and I'm like, we're badass bitches.
You are badass bitches.
Something like that.
You are badass bitches. Just don't join a secret sorority calling yourself badass bitches. Just don't do that. You're the actual badass bitch. You like what you hear? Please do give us a rating, a review, and subscribe on iTunes or wherever you listen. Every little bit helps us get this cult awareness content out there. Smash that subscribe button. You know what to do. Well, that is about it. This was definitely one of the docuseries that I was most troubled by, and I was texting Eric throughout the whole thing, Eric Skrzynski of the Preacher Boys, trying to find out who was in jail and who'd been held accountable. He's like, you have to wait till you get to the end. It does end on a triumphant moment. Certainly shocked at the footage they were able to get from inside the court. I think that survivors from all different groups will be inspired by what these women have done. And there is one line about basically, you know, and I've been guilty of this as well. Like when I'll attribute some of the strength and my growth from this experience. And it's sort of like attempt to, you know, make lemonade out of lemons or find silver linings or whatever, but basically saying, don't give them credit for your strengths. Don't give your abusers credit. And I agree with that. And I'm going to shift that perspective moving forward for myself. So I learned a lot from this episode. And I hope that you did too. And if you haven't watched the series, we highly recommend it. Please let us know what you thought. And we'll see you next time on A Little Bit Culty. Sinking down to the depths of the ocean. I'm hanging on to the weight of my love. If I let go of it all, I could leave. But I know I won't. Thanks for listening, everyone. We're heading over to patreon.com/alittlebitculty now to discuss this episode. In the meantime, dear listener, please remember, this podcast is solely for general informational, educational, and entertainment purposes. It's not intended as a substitute for real medical, legal, or therapeutic advice. For cult recovery resources and to learn more about seeking safely in this culty world, check out alittlebitculty.com/culty resources and don't miss Sarah's TED Talk called How Cult Literate Are You? Great stuff. A Little Bit Culty is a Trace 120 production, executive produced by Sarah Edmondson and Anthony Nippy Ames, in collaboration with producer Will Rutherford at Citizens of Sound and our co-creator and show chaplain / bodyguard, Jess Temple Tardy. Our show writer is Holly Zadra, and our theme song, Cultivated, is by John Bryant.